Well, thanks for coming, everybody. I'll tell you a little bit about how this review came about. Actually, I'm reprising it tonight. It was, I hit the button, Lucy. And the little light is red. As we say in Arkansas, I mashed the button. You know. Valparaiso University does a 7-week series in January and February every year called Books and Coffee. And it's a series of public book reviews put on by various people from throughout the university. They're not all faculty members, and they're certainly not all from the English department. And they review books that have been selling well and that have been showing up on the bestseller lists. And if this had gone off when it was supposed to 1 month ago, I would have handed out little flyers that told you what was going to be reviewed. But as I said, there are only 7 of them. And that was a month ago, and there's only one left. But so maybe next year you can catch some of the Books and Coffee book reviews. They're 4 o'clock on Thursday afternoons. They're open to the public, and they're generally either in the student union or the university union or over in the library, the front of the library. So I would encourage you in the future, you might be interested in attending some of those reviews. Anyways, the book I'm reviewing tonight is one that's done very well. It's a novel called The Yellow Birds by an author named Kevin Powers. And here's what it looks like. You can see it's not a long read. It's not a big, thick tome by any means. But I wanted to begin this evening by making some very general observations about war fiction, particularly in American literature. Okay, there's an old army joke that goes like this. What is the only difference between a fairy tale and a war story? Anybody know? Well, the fairy tale always begins once upon a time, and a war story always begins, hey, this is no BS. Now, that joke does highlight a couple of things about war fiction. The first has to do with the speaker's insistence on the story's authenticity. Successful fiction in general, always needs to ring true to human nature, even if it's in the genre of fantasy. But in war fiction, which is almost always grounded in some particular historical moment, achieving that quality of believability or verisimilitude, the feeling that it could or that it did happen, becomes particularly important. As author Tim O'Brien explains about a war story in his novel, The Things They Carried, without that grounding in reality, it's just a trite bit of puffery. A second point about the joke concerns the credibility of the storyteller. Specifically in the joke, one may infer from the teller's claim to truth that he appears to have been a participant in the conflict or an observer, or at the very least, has heard the story from a trusted source who has, or who was. John Lewis, who's the editor of a major anthology of 20th century war fiction, claims in his introduction to the volume that war fiction is, quote, invariably fictionalized autobiography. And that claim's largely accurate. It does seem that the most enduring war fiction tends to come from those who have been there and done that, or at least been personal observers of the conflict. Now, the most significant exception to that general rule is, of course, Stephen Crane's novel, The Red Badge of Courage. Crane was not even born until the Civil War was over, and he had never heard a shot fired in anger when he wrote that classic novel. The author of The Yellow Birds, Kevin Powers, is himself a veteran of the war in Iraq. He was born and raised in Richmond, Virginia. He served as a machine gunner in Iraq in 2004 and 2005. And then he went on to Virginia Commonwealth University and to the University of Texas at Austin, where he earned an MFA and he was a Michener Fellow in poetry. There are many autobiographical parallels between Powers, the author, and the book's protagonist, whose name is John Bartle. And he's nicknamed Bart. And there's obvious parallels. Both are from Richmond. Both are poets. Both served in infantry platoons. Powers, the author, fought in and around the city of Tel Afar in Nineveh Province, Iraq. And Bart, in the novel, the protagonist in the novel, fights in and around a city named Al-Tafar, also in Nineveh province in Iraq. And in an interview with the British Guardian newspaper, Powers acknowledges their shared, quote, biographical and geographical details, but he explains that he didn't lose a friend the way Bartle did. Powers goes on to explain that, quote, the core of what Bartle goes through, I empathized with it. I felt those things, and I asked the same questions. Is there anything about this that's redeeming? Does asking in itself have value? The story is invented, but there's a definite alignment between Bartle's emotional and mental life and mine, end quote. Much American war fiction is narrated from the viewpoint of the private soldier, often an infantryman. The infantryman, that's the foot soldier, the one whose job it is to close with and destroy the enemy, thus frequently becomes the quintessential GI, the average Joe, the everyman figure of war fiction. And The Yellow Birds is written in that tradition. The story centers around three characters. 21-year-old Private John Bartle, nicknamed Bart, and he's the narrator through whose eyes we view everything. Private Daniel Murphy, nicknamed Murph, 3 years younger than Bart, from rural southwestern Virginia, who comes into the Army naive, sensitive, and largely without the capacity to process what he's to encounter in combat. And the third character is Sergeant Sterling, a 24-year-old battle-hardened veteran, non-commissioned officer, who had been in the first Gulf War, and who, quote, had been decorated so that even the higher-ups looked at him with admiration, end quote. The company commander even tells the troop, Sergeant Sterling will be put on the recruiting posters, men. Mark my words. And indeed, the sergeant is a sterling example of what seems like a stereotype of the tough-as-nails veteran sergeant keeping his soldiers and himself alive with his experience and his no-nonsense ethic. And as flat and stereotypical a character as Sergeant Sterling appears to be through most of the book, in the end, he turns out to be exactly what the Army has made him. And that's not necessarily all bad. Now, I'm intentionally speaking a little cryptically here because to explain much more than what I've said would be to reveal how the book ends and what becomes of Sergeant Sterling. I don't want to do that. More so than the other characters, I suspect Sergeant Sterling will leave many readers scratching their heads and wondering just what to make of this guy. The story is not told in a straightforward chronological fashion, but it's a retrospective through Bart's memory and his coming to grips, or at least attempting to come to grips with what he's been through in Iraq, and in particular, with events leading to the death of Murph. The book's 11 chapters alternate between time past in Nineveh province and time past in the United States, mostly in Richmond, shortly after Bart returns from Iraq and leaves active duty. Thus, we get the story in a somewhat fragmented, pieces, much like the narrator's own memory working as he tries to make sense of things. Bart meets Murph when they're in basic training, and then the two are assigned to the same infantry unit, and Sergeant Murphy enters the picture when the unit is undergoing training in preparation for deployment. Bart and Murph aren't particularly close, and as their training comes to an end, Sergeant Sterling orders Bart to watch out for Murph. And then at a sort of a graduation ceremony following which the unit has some time to spend with their families and friends, Bart meets LaDonna Murphy, Murph's mom, and a rural mail carrier. And in the second chapter, Bart makes a promise to Mrs. Murphy that sets up the rest of the book. And I'll read it to you. Now, I have to tell you at this point that due to the venue that we're in, I'm going to do something that I normally don't do when reading from a book, and I'm going to censor passages as I read them. I'll drop certain adjectives and interjections, and where that's nearly impossible, I'll substitute a word or use a first letter of a word. And I've actually been doing that already, what little I've quoted from the book. Okay, and again, this is Bart talking to Mrs. Murphy. She released me from her embrace and said excitedly, "I'm just so proud of you guys. Daniel's told me so much about you. I feel like I know you already." "Yes, ma'am, me too." "So y'all getting to be good friends?" I looked over at Murph, and he gave me an apologetic shrug. "Yes, ma'am," I said. "We room together and everything." "Well, I want you to know, if y'all need anything, I'm going to take care of you. Y'all get more care packages than anyone." "That's really kind of you, Mrs. Murphy." Sterling called Murph to help another private sweep up red, white, and blue confetti from around the three-point line of the court. "And you're going to look out for him, right?" she asked. "Yes, ma'am." "And Daniel, he's doing a good job?" "Yes, ma'am, very good." "How the hell should I know, lady?" I wanted to say. "I barely know the guy. Stop asking me questions. I don't want to be accountable. I don't know anything about this." "John, promise me you'll take care of him." "Of course." "Sure," I thought. "Now, you reassure me and I'll go back and go to bed." "Nothing's going to happen to him, right? Promise me that. Promise me you'll bring him home to me." "I promise," I said. "I promise I'll bring him home to you." Now, we already know that something bad happened to Murph. Bart told us that in the first chapter, that he, quote, was invincible until the day he was not. But when Bart makes this promise, we know that it will ultimately prove a foolish one, and one he's unable to keep. The story then follows Bartle and Murphy as they deploy to Nineveh province and engage in heavy fighting in and around the city of Altafar. As time goes by, the war wears especially hard on Murph, who, as I mentioned earlier, has a certain innocence or fragility about him. His desire to leave Iraq becomes overwhelming, and he cannot keep focused on the present. Both Sterling and Bartle know how dangerous this is for Murphy, or, as Sergeant Sterling explains, "If you get back to the States in your head before your ass is there too, then you're a dead man. I'm telling you." Murph takes to wandering away from his platoon when his unit is in its base camp and going over to watch, from a bit of a distance, a young, compassionate woman medic at work at the aid station. He does so not because he has some sort of romantic designs on the medic, but rather, as Bart tells it, because, quote, he wanted to see something kind, and, quote, he wanted to have one memory he'd made of his own volition to balance out the shattered remnant of everything he hadn't asked for, end quote. When the medic is killed in an enemy mortar attack on the forward operating base, Murph becomes unhinged. And thus begins the chain of events that the reader knew was coming and that to some degree Bart and Sergeant Sterling have themselves anticipated. We've known since very early in the story that Bart has been racked with guilt over Murphy's death and over the broken promise to Murphy's mother. As the story unfolds, it becomes increasingly apparent that Bartle does not simply suffer because Murphy died, but as the result of some role that Bart himself played in the circumstances surrounding the young soldier's death. One area in which Power succeeds quite well is building and maintaining the suspense about just how Murph meets his end, and what causes Bart to feel so consumed with guilt about it. Here the tension becomes almost unbearable at times. We realize that Bartle's feelings go beyond guilt that he's broken his promise to Murphy's mother, and beyond feeling guilty for letting a buddy down, but there's something else, something that Bartle himself did in connection with the death that racks him unmercifully. And the twists that occur in the climax of the novel are quite original. Now, I don't want to be a spoiler here again, so I'm not going to say what those are. But I will say that if you're expecting Bartle to fatally betray Murphy or do something negligent or cowardly at a critical juncture or kill Murphy himself, or you're expecting either Murphy or Bartle to go on some sort of killing spree or similar viciousness, that's not it at all. None of that happens. But what does happen is quite plausible, and does one leave one wondering whether, in the circumstances, you or I might have decided it was the rational and humane thing to do. Indeed, the plot twists around Murphy's death save the novel from lapsing into some of the stereotypes that Powers borders on in many pages. The climactic action is, in fact, consistent with one of the most common plot devices in American literary realism, in which events of life cause the protagonist to have to make a significant moral choice, such as when Silas Lapham must decide whether or not to sell his paint company, or Huck Finn must decide whether or not to turn Jim in. To return to a bit of the business of war fiction being something like fictionalized autobiography, and to the empathy between author Powers and narrator Bartle, remember that Powers, the author, is a poet, and this is his first novel. The narrator's poetic sensibilities are quite evident throughout the story. Quite often he describes the scenery and action through passages that are rich in lyricism and figurative language. For example, listen for the extended personification in the book's very memorable opening lines. And this is actually some of the best prose in the book. The war tried to kill us in the spring. As grass greened the plains of Nineveh and the weather warmed, we patrolled the low-slung hills beyond the cities and towns. We moved over them and through the tall grass on faith, kneading paths into the wind-swept growth like pioneers. While we slept, the war rubbed its thousand ribs against the ground in prayer. When we pressed onward through exhaustion, its eyes were white and open in the dark. While we ate, the war fasted, fed by its own deprivation. It made love and gave birth and spread through fire. Then in summer, the war tried to kill us as the heat blanched all color from the plains. The sun pressed into our skin, and the war sent its citizens rustling into the shade of white buildings. It cast a white shade on everything, like a veil over our eyes. It tried to kill us every day, but it had not succeeded. Not that our safety was preordained. We were not destined to survive. The fact is, we were not destined at all. The war would take what it could get. It was patient. It didn't care about objectives or boundaries, whether you were loved by many or not at all. While I slept that summer, the war came to me in my dreams and showed me its sole purpose, to go on, only to go on, and I knew that the war would have its way. The narrator mentions the sun being like a white veil over our eyes in that passage. And indeed, at times, it seems as if we, as readers, are watching the war entirely through something like gauze or the soft focus lens of the narrator's memory. And this may be exactly the effect that Powers aims for, but it can become a bit much at times. That is to say, other passages in the book, like the one I just read, and there are many, are not as successful as that one. And they tend to call attention more to the language itself rather than to what we as readers are supposed to be seeing or taking in. And occasionally we hit a clunker of a simile such as, clouds spread out over the Atlantic like soiled linens on an unmade bed. Part of Private Murphy's fate also involves an important bit of biblical allusion that is a bit too heavy-handed, I thought. And no, he doesn't become a Christ figure, if that's what you're wondering. And that particular one is not the only biblical allusion in the book. Interestingly enough, there's two other prominent ones. All three of them involve Sergeant Sterling. About midway through the book, Sterling sprinkles salt over some ground of a village that they've over part of the town that they've just attacked, and says, "Hey, it's in Judges." And he's right. Abimelech does that in Judges 9:45. And then early in the book, Sterling breaks a pound cake out of a combat ration, and he hands pieces out, and he tells Bartle and Murph, "Take, eat." More on that in just a minute. One of the real difficulties of writing war fiction from the view of the individual infantryman is dealing with the nuances of an infantry platoon. An army unit in the field is a team, and for conventional forces anyways, Even the smaller teams, like the platoon, have many players. Too many for most works of fiction to adequately contain. Platoons are divided into three or four squads of around 10 or 11 soldiers, and squads into teams of four or five, and these are typically led by sergeants or corporals. Even in a badly understrength platoon, the distinctions between squads typically remain. And this structure, with its attendant organizational dynamics, normally gets lost in fictional portrayals. And so it is in this book. The novel concentrates on the three main characters, with the platoon leader, that is the lieutenant, as a relatively minor character, although he is an earnest and sympathetic one. Now, I did appreciate the fact that Powers does not characterize the lieutenant in the frequent stereotype of a naive, incompetent know-nothing. At one point in the book, a colonel, who would have to be either the battalion or brigade commander, we don't know which, makes an appearance to give a pre-battle pep talk. And he's obviously a character more interested in garnering favorable publicity for himself than being sincerely concerned for his troops. And I'll read you the way his speech ends. Again, this is the ending. If you die, know this. We'll put you on the first bird to Dover. Your families will have a distinction beyond all others. If these bastards want to fight, we're going to give them one. He paused. A look of great sentimentality came over him. I can't go with you, boys, he explained with regret. But I'll be in contact from the operations center the whole time. Give them hell. Do such people exist in the Army? Of course they do. But my experience was that they were very much in the minority and typically only advanced so far. Another area in which the narration didn't quite ring true for me occurs in the manner that Sergeant Sterling and the lieutenant talk to their soldiers. Frequently, both characters will use the term boys as a form of direct address. Now, perhaps times have changed, but in the 25 years of active duty service, 4 as a full-time cadet and 21 as an infantryman myself, I don't think I ever heard an officer or non-commissioned officer address a group of soldiers as boys. It was always men, or some colorful appellation based on the male genitalia. This might seem like a very minor point, and one that I should just get over. And indeed, I don't want to make much of this. Nevertheless, in my own reading of the book, it did become a distraction from the novel's verisimilitude. I have to say that one stereotype that I really tire of and resent is that of the wigged out, maladjusted veteran, unable to function or make any sort of worthwhile contribution to society after being in combat. Now, of course, unfortunately, that sort of thing can and does happen. And those who have served are forever changed by their experience. But the vast majority do not become the utterly dysfunctional or violent individuals often depicted in popular culture. In The Yellow Birds, Kevin Powers does come close to this with the character of Bartle. However, in the very end, Bartle does seem to be recovering and coming to grips with all that he's been through. And Powers can also be very successful at capturing the alienation and frustration that many veterans feel upon returning from combat. Now here's one particularly powerful passage that occurs not long after Bart returns home and is having tremendous difficulty relating to the questions that folks often ask him. Then even your mother is so happy and proud because you lined up your sight post and made people crumple and they were not getting up ever. And yeah, they might have been trying to kill you too. So you say, what are you going to do? But really it doesn't matter because by the end you failed at the one good thing you could have done. The one person you promised would live is dead. And you've seen all things die in more manners than you'd like to recall. And for a while, the whole thing ravaged your spirit like some deep down stuff, man. And you didn't even realize you had only the animals, and you realized you had until only the animals made you sad. the husks of dogs filled with explosives and old artichokes and the guts and everything stinking like metal and burning garbage, and you'll walk around and the smell is deep down into you now, and you say, how can metal be so on fire? And where is all this trash coming from? And even back home, you're getting whiffs of it. And then that thing you started to notice slipping away is gone, and now it's becoming inverted, like you've bottomed out in your spirit, but yet a deeper hole is being dug because everybody is so happy to see you, the murderer, the accomplice, the at bare minimum bearer of some responsibility, and everyone wants to slap you on the back, and you start to burn the whole GD country down. You want to burn every GD yellow ribbon in sight, and you can't explain it, but it's just like, F you, but then you signed up to go, so it's all your fault, really, because you went on purpose. So you are in the end doubly effed. So why not just find a spot and curl up and die, and let's make it as painless as possible, because you are a coward. And really, cowardice got you into this mess because you wanted to be a man, and people made fun of you and pushed you around in the cafeteria and the hallways in high school because you like to read books and poems sometimes, and they call you fag. And really deep down, you know you went because you wanted to be a man, and that's never going to happen now, and you're too much of a coward to be a man and get it over with. So why not find a clean, dry place and wait it out, and wait it out with it hurting as little as possible, and just wait to go to sleep and not wake up and F them all. On a related note, you might be wondering about the title The Yellow Birds and where that comes from. It's not a unit mascot or a nickname that Bart and Murphy give themselves. I'd offer two thoughts here. At one point in the story, Bart is immersed in his memories of mirth and recalls this. I think of a time when we sat in the evening in the guard tower, watching the war go by in streaks of red and green and other briefer lights, and he'd tell me of an afternoon in the little hillside apple orchard that his mother worked, the turn and flash of a paring knife along a wrap of gauze as they grafted uppers to rootstocks and new branches to blossom, or the time he saw, but could not explain his awe, when his father brought a dozen caged canaries home from the mine and let them loose in the hollow where they lived. How the canaries only flitted and sang a while before perching back atop the cages, which had been arranged in rows, his father likely thinking that the birds would not return by choice to their captivity. Here the suggestion that the soldiers are somewhat like the canaries, giving up their freedom and song, seems fairly obvious. The book has two epigraphs, and one is a well-worn marching song that I wish I'd had a nickel for every time I've heard. It's done call and response style, and it goes simply, a yellow bird with a yellow bill was sitting on my windowsill. I lured him in with a piece of bread, and then I smashed his little head. Powers has been quite forthcoming about this epigraph, explaining that as he wrote the novel, that song echoed in his head, and the bird, who was lured in and then killed, comes to represent, quote, the lack of control soldiers have over what happens to them. The war proceeds no matter what you think or do. It's an entity unto itself. You're powerless, and powerlessness itself becomes the enemy. That was my emotional experience of the war. The idea of the bird resonated with the core of what I was trying to get at. End quote. Now, although the novel closes on a mildly optimistic note, I can't even really call it hope, and it's certainly not redemption. Bart survives, and in the end, he even seems a little more accepting of the world, without any of a world that didn't at the time make any sort of order or seem to have any sense to it. Sergeant Sterling doesn't survive the war, and remember, he's the one that these biblical allusions center on. And the only observation I'll make there right now is that they do seem to run backwards through time, beginning with the New Testament, and in the end of the novel, run back to very early in the Old Testament. If there's a message there, I'm not sure. I really can't tell. Two literary critics who were giants in the field of American Civil War literature, Edmund Wilson and Daniel Aaron, both noted the relatively long gap in time between the war's end and the appearance of really enduring fiction about the war. It wasn't until roughly 20 years after that war was over that much fiction that we still read today began to appear. But what Wilson and Aaron describe is not unique to the Civil War. With some exceptions, it's happened in every American war since. The pause, or literary dearth, as Daniel Aaron called it, in the wake of the Civil War, might simply be a characteristic wait for an artistically gifted participant or observer to emerge. Much of the best fiction concerning subsequent American wars appeared at least 10 years after their conclusions. It seemed that telling what Ernest Hemingway described as a truer account than anything factual takes time, reflection, and distancing. Interestingly enough, it's been the poets who seem to produce enduring war literature during and immediately after the conflicts. Given the time frame of our involvement in Iraq and the almost pastoral lyricism that Kevin Powers brings to the images of war in this book, as in the example I read from the book's opening, Powers writes a sort of prose poetry. And in that sense, this book seems right on schedule. On the book's dust jacket, famous author Tom Wolfe blurbs that the Yellow Birds is, quote, "the all quiet on the western front of America's Arab wars," end quote. Well, All Quiet on the Western Front first appeared exactly 85 years ago last month. If the Yellow Birds is indeed the all quiet of America's Arab wars, as Tom Wolfe claims, then we would expect folks to be reading this novel 85 years from now. Despite its fine attributes and originality, there's enough holding this book back that I would have to classify it as a good book, but not a great book, and not one that I expect folks will be talking about in 2097. Will we get something like an All Quiet out of the United States involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan? I don't know. It's still early yet. Thank you. And I think we have a little bit of time for questions. Anyone has any questions? Lucy?
No, I wondered, what is the defense of a squeamish person, or like, well, how could you convince a squeamish person like me to read a book like this? I read things they carry. You know, that sounds hard to read.
Right.
But what would be the advantage for somebody like myself to read a book like that?
How would I convince you to read it?
Well, or the value, what would be the value of it? You know, to overcome my...
Well, now, if you could read The Things They Carried, you could read this one.
Okay.
I'll say that. I think the value in it is, particularly in a book like The Things They Carried, there are parts of that book where you really do get a pretty good glimpse into sort of the life of an infantryman. And I think that's really the value of it. Now, I would say if you don't want a glimpse of that, then then don't read the book. But I think it's important to sort of know what you're sending your daughters and sons off into when the decision's made to go to war. The Things They Carried does give you a sense of that in many of its sections, not entirely. Now, I will say this, and then I'll sort of step off the soapbox about The Things They Carried. The Things They Carried, I think, even more so than a book about war, is a book about stories. It's a book about telling stories and the power of and the function of storytelling. And it really uses kind of war stories as its vehicle to do that. Stan?
The passage that you censored specifically was the reason for use of slang words or taking war's name in vain.
taking the Lord's name in vain, and because I dropped out just certain words because I didn't feel it was really appropriate to read them here. Others? Other questions?
I assume this was out in New York.
Yeah. Yeah.
When did this come up?
I want to say late last year. September 2012 was its first edition.
Did you tell them that you were assigned to this book, that you didn't just pick it up and leave it and say how many years?
Oh, no, I didn't say that. I was assigned to do this book for Books and Coffee.
I thought,
right.
Yeah. Would you say, I mean, is the author's objective, objective point in writing the book, I mean, is it, maybe if you reflect on that a bit, is it an anti-war, is it to make an anti-war statement, or some statement about the Iraq War specifically, or
no, I do not think it's that's a good question. I do think it's pretty hard to write up. I don't know how anybody can really write a pro-war book. I mean, you can, but it strikes me as being pretty irresponsible. it's not to make a statement on the Iraq War so much as I think it is to make a statement about the impact of combat on young soldiers and sort of the trauma of that. There are spots in the book where I think you can really see that coming through, Rick, where he's trying not to wed the story so much to Iraq that, say, if the book were being read 100 years from now, you would need to know a lot about, you know, the Iraq War to really get the book. It really is much more a story of individual soldiers in combat, and it happens to be set in the Iraq War. Is the way I'd characterize it.
That passage you read was very moving and so sad.
Which one?
The one where he went on and on and on and on and talked about being a man and all that.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the reason I was reading that is because there are no periods in that. That's his mind just running, you know, and his, him being racked with feelings of guilt. You can see that same kind of thing in, I think, for example, it shows up in Things That Carried a few times. And in Ernest Hemingway's story, Soldier's Home, if you've ever read that short story, we see many of those same kind of feelings. Told very differently, but thematically very similar. Yeah?
Having never served myself, being that age where I live between things, is this, for those who end up going like to Iraq, Matt, is this a very common type trauma for them? I mean, that they're all feeling this way when they come home?
I say the basic feelings are fairly common, but not so severe. Not so severe, and I think this character has to cope with, involving the death of Murphy is really kind of unique, and it would be a rather extraordinary circumstance that I think most soldiers would not run into. And you got to think now, okay, the author of this book seems to be doing pretty well, and you know he's writing in part based on his own experiences. So apparently he made the transition or made the adjustment. But you sometimes get, you know, survivor syndrome can be very back in. That feeling that, once back from a combat tour, sometimes that feeling of, gosh, nothing else just seems really important, you know. are nearly so important, and there's not the sense of urgency and that sort of thing. Any other questions? Well, thank you all very much.
Thank you.